If we haven't met yet, I'm Paul, and I'm one of the preaching team here at Sutton Vineyard, and I hope you are doing mighty fine this very warm morning. Now, if you were here last week for our all-in service, you'll have seen me get very stressed building a Jenga tower along with Tom Speed, who, by the way, was an excellent building partner. You'll have also heard Julian talk about us being living stones and about building up our faith. Very much in keeping with our current series in Nehemiah, and that is the correct way to pronounce it. I would say so. I'd say it was Nehemiah, but you feel free to pronounce it differently and be wrong. And therefore, he was talking about that, and something I just want to, pun intended, build on this morning. Anyway, firstly, I think we should all appreciate that we are in the building trade, at least metaphorically speaking. We build careers, relationships, habits, homes, and crucially, many of us spend time and energy building up our faith. We build because we're made in the image of a God who builds, a creative God. In the beginning, God spoke and creation came into being. He brought something out of nothing. A thought became reality. And we do something very similar every time we bring an idea to life, a friendship, a prayer, a project, a family, a community. But that also means that what's going on in our hearts and our minds deeply affects how and what we build. And I suspect all of us, if we stop and consider it, want to build well. Whether it's in our faith, our families, or our futures, we want what we build to stand the test of time. And especially so when we look at the state of the world around us, which can appear so fragmented and fragile. Well, the good news is that we are continuing on in the book of Nehemiah this morning, focusing on chapters 3 and 4. And in there, I believe we're going to see some valuable insights that can guide us as we consider what it looks like to build well and why that even matters. So let me pray for us, and then we'll get going in earnest. Father, thank you for this opportunity to look at your word together. I pray that you would open our hearts and our minds to whatever it is that you have for us this morning. Amen. All right, quickest of reminders. God's people were exiled to Babylon. They came back after 70 years and had to rebuild their destroyed temple, which we saw happen in the book of Ezra and here in the book of Nehemiah, named after the man in charge of the restoration process. We see them starting to rebuild the city walls. Today, we're going to pick it up in chapter 3, where reconstruction of the city walls has begun in earnest. Now, I've split this talk into two parts, one part for each chapter, and I've called the first part the importance of hidden work. So let's get on with that. Now, I'm just going to tell you up front that when you read chapter 3, you're going to see a long list of family names and gates that got fixed. It's one of those areas of the Bible that can feel a bit lost to us, to be candid. It's just a list of people we've never heard of, doing stuff to a place we've never seen. I'll give you an example right from the start of chapter 3. Eliashib the high priest and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. They dedicated and set its doors in place, building as far as the Tower of the Hundred, which they dedicated, and as far as the Tower of Hananel. The men of Jericho built the adjoining section, and Zaccur, son of Imri, built next to them. Now, if we sped through the rest of chapter 3, we'd see a lot more like this, a list of people and the parts of the city that they rebuilt. The sheep gate, the fish gate, the old gate, the valley gate, the dung gate, lovely. The fountain gate, this wall here, that wall there, on it goes. As it happens, this work is clearly recorded for us in Nehemiah 3, but at first glance, we might be tempted to view this all as very skippable. To some extent, this record maybe even feels kind of unremarkable, right? A list of people, places, and the work they completed. But it's actually remarkable in its lack of the miraculous. It feels like if any of us were there and picked up some of the tools, we could have been listed in Nehemiah 3. And that's kind of the point. Because most of the time, God's kingdom is not built through the spectacular, but through ordinary people faithfully doing the work that is right in front of them. The visible, enduring parts of God's kingdom often rest on hidden and sometimes uncelebrated foundations of obedience, perseverance, and love. So often that work goes unnoticed by others, but it is not missed by God. I, for one, sometimes catch myself feeling a little sour that the things that I do don't get the accolades and acknowledgements I feel they deserve. If only the people knew. But only the good things. But that's me getting the wrong end of the stick, because in those moments, I'm really just looking for validation. And it's easily done because the world trains us to expect that all our activities need to be liked, shared, and subscribed in order to be valid. Pics, they say. No, it didn't happen. It's the culture of performance, that everything worthwhile must be visible and praised. But the Bible and Jesus himself affirms the total opposite. Here's Jesus talking about giving in Matthew chapter 6. But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving may be in secret. Then your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you. This is an important starting point. Now, we don't know for sure, but it seems highly likely to me that the people who were rebuilding the wall at Jerusalem weren't looking for any validation. They really just believed in what they were doing and wanted to be a part of the work. In fact, when we get to looking at chapter 4, I suspect it'll become very clear that they weren't doing this for the recognition that it got. But there's so much more than just names and gates here in chapter 3 of Nehemiah if we look a little closer. Here's a couple of things that I've been reflecting on. First, we see both bad and good leadership on display. In amongst the people, being busy and doing the stuff, we get verse 5. The next section of the wall was repaired by the men of Tekoa, but their nobles would not put their shoulders to the work under their supervisors. Got it. Okay. So the well-to-do feel that this here manual work is a little bit beneath them, and they don't want to take orders from their lessers, thank you very much. But by way of contrast, let's look at everyone's favorite gate, the dung gate. And now when we cover this in our theology gathering on a Tuesday, my daughter was like, whoa, 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 whoa. Do we mean like dung, dung? And I'm like, yeah, stinky. Yes. Anyway, we might assume that the dung gate would be rebuilt by the lowest of the low, given what it is, but no. The dung gate was repaired by Malchijah, son of Rechab, ruler of the district of Beth Hakarem. He rebuilt it and put its doors with their bolts and bars in place. Now, make of this what you will, but I personally read in both of these verses the very things I notice around me today. That the most effective leaders are the ones who will stick their hands in the muck, in this case, quite possibly literally, to get the job done. And that respect is earned by action much more readily than through status or titles. And for what it's worth, the job often just needs to get done, and it doesn't really matter who does it. The other thing I wanted to call out from chapter 3 is this. Uzziel, son of Harhiah, one of the goldsmiths, repaired the next section, and Hananiah, one of the perfume makers, made repairs next to that. They restored Jerusalem as far as the broad wall. A goldsmith and a perfumier, cracking on and building walls and doing quite a bit of it as far as we can tell. Who'd have thunk? If we've ever found ourselves thinking or feeling that we're ill-suited to the work of God's kingdom, and I know I have, there is encouragement here. What do you do for a living? Ah, perfumes and walls. That is a mighty fine smelling wall you've got going on there. That's a whole new range right there. Brick by Dior. I made it weird again. Anyway, in all, there are dozens of family names, but most of the people doing the work in chapter 3 remain anonymous. The wall gets built because they show up. Each person quietly getting on and building what needs to be built, dealing with the things that are right in front of them. Adjoining this, Jediah, son of Haramath, made repairs opposite his house. Morning world, oh, it's a wall, let me rebuild it. And Hattush, son of Hashbaniah, made repairs next to him. Morning, Hattush, shall we build a wall? Yes, let's. Now, naturally enough, we could look at this whole thing as a picture of modern church life, with many of us serving during the week or on a Sunday, being part of a rota and so forth. Some of us, as perfumiers, somehow thrust into building walls and feeling a bit out of sorts, messy, perhaps even haphazard at times, but a glorious mess all the same. And we see God working through it all because he's good like that. And I'd absolutely agree with that view that this is about our collective life as a church. But I also want to suggest this morning that we can see it as a more personal picture of how we individually build our lives. Each of us is dealing with our own different sections of the metaphorical wall, so to speak. Relationships, responsibilities, struggles, jobs, care duties, daily routines, and disciplines. And these might not seem impressive or even visible to others, but working on these is absolutely essential. What we're taking the time to build in the day-to-day, often quietly and patiently, and occasionally incorrectly, is a critical part of God's kingdom. And even if nobody else is seeing the apparently thankless work we're doing, God knows, notices, and cares, just like he did the people rebuilding the walls at Jerusalem. You know, it's not always showy work, and it's not always the fastest work either. Jesus started his earthly ministry at 30 years old, so you have to wonder, what was he doing for the preceding 29 years? The extremely short summary of that is Luke 2:52. And Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. The point is, Jesus was doing the quiet work. His visible ministry, which started age 30, was built on a private and hidden foundation. And even during his ministry, he'd take himself off for quiet periods of prayer and recharge, doing the anonymous work, the quiet work with God the Father. Now, did you know that York Minster, the massive cathedral in, shocker, York, is built atop 2,000-year-old Roman foundations? Some of you knew that, maybe, maybe not. I didn't, and now you do too. The Roman fortress on which the cathedral stands was long buried and forgotten, and only rediscovered when they started some repair works on the central tower. These foundations provided unknown, hidden, physical support to the cathedral for nearly two millennia. And nobody apart from maybe even the first builders actually knew that. And here's another thought. The Romans who set down the fortress had no idea that someday it would underpin a cathedral. Similarly, it's important we remember that we won't necessarily find out what God will build on the foundations that we lay with him. Here's a more modern example for you. This is what our house looked like. Lovely. A few years ago when the builders were replacing an old wooden joist at the back of our house with 2 tons of steel as part of some renovation work. Fun fact, we did it in COVID. Pro tip, don't. If you came to our house now, you'd be able to guess where the steel is, I'm sure. But you wouldn't see it directly. And yet without it, our house would collapse. The unspoken, hidden work that we are doing is building our lives and, by extension, the church of tomorrow, one painstaking brick at a time. So what's our section of the wall, collectively or individually? Where are we called to be faithful, even when nobody else sees it? The home? The hospital bed? The gym? The workplace? Sometimes I find we can tie ourselves in knots, wondering if we found God's big mission, the GBM, for our lives. And to be sure, some of us absolutely are called to do very visible things. But I would suggest that the vast majority of our lives is just us doing the hidden things, the foundational things that literally nobody else but God sees. And chances are the stuff that you'll do for the kingdom will be whatever is right in front of you. And that's good. It may be hidden to others, but like the foundations of a building or a wall, it absolutely matters. Right, let's move to part two, the blessing and battle of building. Supposing we agree that yes, lots of what we do is hidden, but in some way important, we will now see why it's actually critical that we do it. Let's look at the opening of Nehemiah 4, where the leaders from the surrounding peoples take great exception to the building work that God's people are doing. When Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became angry and was greatly incensed. He ridiculed the Jews, and in the presence of his associates and the army of Samaria, he said, "What are those feeble Jews doing? Will they restore their wall? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they finish in a day?" It's not Rome. "Can they build the stone, bring the stones back to life from those heaps of rubble, burned as they are?" And then his friend Tobiah chips in. Tobiah the Ammonite, who was at his side, said, "What they're building, even a fox climbing up on it would break down their wall of stones." Lol. Can't imagine there's a career in stand-up comedy with that kind of zinger, but there we go. The intent to harm is still there. When we choose to build, we should expect opposition, especially as it starts to become visible to others. And the opposition will not always be overt, obvious, or direct. Often it'll be subtle, taking the form of derision, insults, discouragement, or lies. In fact, the American Psychological Association recently shared some research that satire and mockery are far more damaging than direct criticism. Mockery has a way of lodging rent-free in people's heads in a way that other stuff just doesn't seem to. So perhaps you can see why I thought God's people weren't exactly in this for the recognition. It is starting to look very not fun. But you've got to hand it to them here, because rather than being fazed by the extremely vocal insults and mockery that's coming their way, they seem instead to use it as fuel. So we rebuilt the wall till all of it reached half its height, for the people worked with all their heart. Of course, now that the initial approach has failed, the Samaritans and the Ammonites surrounding the Jewish remnant that are rebuilding the city walls, things start to get heated with intimidation and threats of violence. They all, that's these same people, plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. But we prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. There is a beautiful balance here. We prayed to our God and posted a guard day and night. Pray and act. Not pray or act, and. In that order. This is the Nehemiah way of working, and I'm a fan. If you go back to chapters 1 and 2, you see him praying for 4 months and then speaking to the king. My view here, though, is that it is not an act of faith to ignore threats. But we should also be very clear that Nehemiah doesn't start waging a counteroffensive war either. It would be very tempting, I'm sure, to take the fight to the Samaritans, the Ammonites, and whoever else wants some. But that would just give victory to the other side. For while God's people would be waging war, they wouldn't be building city walls. Nehemiah, for me at least, strikes a remarkable balance. He stays alert to threat without abandoning progress. From that day on, half of my men did the work, while the other half were equipped with spears, shields, bows, and armor. The officers posted themselves behind all the people of Judah who were building the wall. Those who carried materials did their work with one hand and held a weapon in the other, and each of the builders wore his sword at his side as he worked. But the man who sounded the trumpet to warn everyone there was trouble stayed with me. That's Nehemiah. There are two powerful images here. There's more, but I've got time for two. First, there's the picture of the sword and the trowel. Each builder worked with tools in one hand and a weapon in the other, building and defending side by side. This image has echoed throughout Christian history, adopted as a symbol of faithful resilience. The trowel represents the daily determined work of building God's kingdom. The sword represents readiness to protect, pray, and persevere. We're called to hold both and to know when to use each one. But there's a second image here that is just as important and maybe a touch easier to miss. The officers posted themselves behind all the people of Judah who were building the city wall. This wasn't a solo mission. The builders didn't carry the burden alone. Some built while others protected. And sometimes it seems the roles flipped. And that's how the kingdom works best. We build and battle together. We pray for one another. We protect each other. We lift each other up when we fall. We cheer each other on when the work is hard. And sometimes it is. This is a team sport, a family task. This is a body, not a solo act. When you're too tired to defend, someone else can take the watch. When your hands are shaking, someone else can carry the sword. When your confidence falters, others can speak courage over you. That is what, a part at least, of what church is meant to be. A people who both build and defend. Not perfectly, but together. Now, while we're here, there is something else I just want to look at briefly. For those of us who've been around church for a while, this idea of holding a sword might raise a fair question. How does all this talk of swords and battle sit alongside Jesus' words in Matthew 5 in his famous Sermon on the Mount? But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. At first glance, carrying a sword, metaphorically speaking, please, doesn't seem to tally with turning the other cheek. But I believe there's a way to hold these two together without contradiction. First, notice that both postures, the sword in Nehemiah and Jesus' teaching, are fundamentally defensive, not offensive. The sword in Nehemiah 4 is about protection, not attack. And Jesus' command is about refusing retaliation, not accepting abuse or abandoning justice. In other words, turning the other cheek is about our personal posture, rejecting revenge, bitterness, and pride. It's how we build the wall of our lives on forgiveness instead of resentment. But this doesn't mean passivity either. And it doesn't mean an abdication of responsibility, especially when others, the vulnerable, the voiceless, need defending. These two truths live together. We are called to be forgiving in spirit and faithful in responsibility. The sword and the cheek, they're not enemies. We should always be ready to defend, but always willing to forgive. For me, though, the activities of Nehemiah 4, of holding trowel and sword, lead on entirely from Nehemiah 3. When we build, we will encounter difficulties and discouragement. And so we have to ask, not just are we building, but on what kind of foundations are we building? Now, at this point, I feel it necessary to sing, "The wise man built his house upon the..." I appreciate you in this heat finishing that for me. The rock, yes. It was a risk. I was willing to take it. Let's fast forward. You know where this is going. Let's fast forward to Jesus, who speaks directly to this in Luke 6. "As for everyone who comes to me and hears my words and puts them into practice, I will show you what they're like. They're like a man building a house who dug down deep and laid the foundation on rock. When a flood came, the torrent struck that house but could not shake it because it was well built. But the one who hears my words and does not put them into practice is like a man who built a house on the ground without a foundation. The moment the torrent struck that house, it collapsed and its destruction was complete." It's not enough to say that we're building, because we can build something without building well. The solid foundation we need is Jesus' teaching. It's a life centered on Christ. It's a life lived in constant reference to and companionship with God's Holy Spirit. And many of us know this, right? Right? Right. Me too. So when I was preparing for this talk, I felt the Spirit point me in that direction to the teaching by Jesus. And I was like, oh, yeah. Yeah, that tracks. Nice. Even talks about foundations too. Let's include that bad boy. I was so happy. So I Googled it to find where it was exactly. And as I looked it up, I was absolutely pinned by the verse that precedes it, where Jesus simply asks, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say?" When I read that, I burst out laughing. And I was in an airport at the time, so I probably looked extra weird. But I laughed because at that moment, I felt completely seen. It was as though, and I think many of us have felt this, it was like the Bible was reading me more than I was reading it. What really happened was God's Holy Spirit was just pulling my attention to this thing that he wanted me to see. To be clear, I laughed because I didn't feel condemned by the Spirit, but firmly challenged, and I was not expecting it. God surprised me. And I was like, fair point, well made. I knew exactly what he was saying to me. And it's something I'm just going to share with you as is. My friends, it is so easy to look the part and not do the work. The reason this hit home for me was because I know there are times I simply don't put the hidden work in. I cut corners with my foundations. Prayer, reflection, reading the Bible. And in the end, it shows. There are no shortcuts to solid foundations. If you want a skyscraper, you've got to dig deep. If you want a house that withstands the torrent, dig down to the rock below. Or as James puts it in his New Testament letter, don't just be hearers of the word, but doers. But building, especially for the long term, is hard work. And it can be really tiring, and it's easy to get worn down. I was recently away from home for work. And while I was away, I didn't have any of my usual responsibilities as a dad, a husband, or even as a friend. I was away in the USA by myself, 8 hours behind the UK, time zone-wise. And all I really had to consider was getting from the hotel to the office, doing my job, and getting back again. In honesty, it was a relief. It was a relief to have a week where I didn't have to consider much of anything, because I'd reached a point where I was just tired, and I was finding it hard to see the value in my day-to-day life. Tired, emotionally and spiritually. Now, as it happened, I was away for Father's Day, just because of when the trip dates fell. And I woke up in my hotel room, to a message from my daughter saying that she had popped a Father's Day card into my suitcase, which I promptly found and opened. In it were messages from my two children, expressing how much they love and value me, of how much I matter to them, of how important over time those day-to-day things as a father that I'd begun to grow weary of truly are. Preparing for this talk has reminded me that small, seemingly insignificant routines and habits lay the foundations for a life that has to withstand fear, uncertainty, doubt, storms, and battles. Just notice that Jesus didn't say if the flood came, but when. The things we do that seem quiet, small, unnoticed, unappreciated, unrewarded, maybe even mocked or derided, are the very materials with which God is building his people and his church. Now, maybe you're stuck and you like one idea to just kickstart something. Here's half a thought. You can adopt, adapt, or abandon if you've got a better one, but I'll throw it to you anyway, see what you think of it. How many of us have a morning tea or coffee? Yeah, good on you. If you don't, start. And also, don't take my morning coffee away from me, because then you'll see you're not nice, Paul. Many of us do. And here's what I want you to do if that's you. Pop a physical Bible next to your kettle with a bookmark in it for, say, Nehemiah 5. Why? Two reasons. One, Nehemiah 5 is where we're going next in the sermon series, so why not? If there's something you'd rather read in the Bible, put the bookmark there, put it there if you want. Yeah, words. The other reason I'd say put a physical Bible there is because it's really hard to ignore a physical Bible compared to a notification on your phone. Now, while you're waiting for the kettle to boil, just read a few verses. That's it. That's all I want you to try. In case you're curious, this is called habit stacking. I've not come up with this. There's a brilliant whole system behind it. Habit stacking. It's a very convenient way of adding the things that you want to do to the things you already know you're going to do. Cup of tea, coffee, Bible. Brilliant. Okay. If the worship team want to come back, I'll bring this to a close. Here's one final thought for you this morning as we come to a close. It is not just about the building, by which I mean the final result. I mean, I know I've kind of talked a lot about that this morning, which kind of makes that awkward, but it's not the whole picture. God doesn't just care about the outcomes. He also cares deeply about the process too, and about us as builders. The journey itself, one of building quiet trust, endurance, and faithfulness, is what shapes our hearts. Who we become is what we carry into eternity, not the things we make. Who we become is what we carry into eternity, not the things we make. So let's keep building. Keep building. Keep building where no one else sees it. Keep building a solid foundation with God, because that's how we learn to weather the storms of life. That's how we learn to carry both the trowel and the sword.